more. They've mentioned Gavin Newsom. It's like throwing darts on the board. And they're going to pair two people together with 3 months left and then trot them out in front of the American public and say, oh, yeah, this is the new ticket, by the way. And oh, the person who won the 2020 election, Joe Biden, he's still not going to come out, right? So now you're going to have a absolute disaster with the Democratic Party, disarray. We're in the press. We know what's going to happen. That's going to be the leading news. It's going to be knives out. Everyone's going to be that VP if Kamala Harris is the president. And that is going to be driving the news. A poll, a very good poll that I want people to talk about. Cornell Belcher, who I trust when it comes to black voters, came out with a poll yesterday that said in swing states, when black voters in swing states saw the debate, their view and their position with Biden did not change. However, for those black voters in swing states who did not watch the debate but read the breathless coverage for the past 2 weeks, that shifted their opinion. And I think we have to talk about this. For the past 2 weeks, what has happened? The Supreme Court, stacked with right-wing extremists, decided to nuke the Chevron doctrine. The Supreme Court decided to make the next president a dictator. Project 2025 is now in the
immunity,
news.
Immunity, giving presidents immunity.
Absolute immunity, yes, for official acts. The president of Heritage Foundation, which is endorsing and creating Project 2025, said we're in this process of a second revolution right now, and it'll be bloodless if the left allows it. Josh Hawley just yesterday said he's a Christian nationalist. Another Christian nationalist, Mike Johnson, approves Trump's plan of camps. And 2 days ago, this is the top of my head, 2 days ago at the rally, Donald Trump said he has no idea what NATO is. This man who was president for 4 years. Meanwhile, Joe Biden, in front of our NATO leaders, got a standing ovation. So the last 2 weeks, imagine if our corporate press and our punditocracy talked about these threats. Don't you think it would influence people? I think it would. But for 2 weeks, nonstop, we've talked about his age, not talking about Donald Trump, who's done nothing for 12 days. And we've talked about, this Democratic infighting. This is Hillary Clinton's butthurt emails on steroids. And I will still say, with 4 months left, what I took from Marine Le Pen's was the polls on Saturday said, I don't know, it looks bad. It seems like she's going to win. At the last second, when democracy was under threat, you saw in the UK, you saw in Brazil, you saw in France, you saw a multiracial coalition come together. And that's what I think is going to happen still. Norm, I know he cares. This is risky. What Norm is proposing is even more risky. I think it will sabotage the only chance we have to save this country from Trump. I have no fidelity to Biden, no fidelity to any other candidate. It's a democracy.
It's particularly interesting you're taking this position. I mean, the squad has taken this position, not exactly Rashida Tlaib or Summer Lee. The Summer Lee said she would endorse Kamala Harris as a presidential candidate. She would support her. But given what's happening right now in Palestine, in Gaza, talk about the massive criticism of President Biden. And you were part of that.
I am part of it.
And yet you are continuing to support him.
Yes. So I think the Biden administration has been a moral failure on Gaza. And I think we all agree, and I'm making an assumption here, that what's happening is a genocide. I think it's time to say it. And I also believe that he isn't complicit in this genocide, and this will be a stain on his legacy. With that being said, Trump will be even worse on Palestine and every other issue. I want to remind people at the debate, because I actually watched it, because I'm a masochist. Trump used the term Palestinian as a pejorative against Biden. Mm-hmm. The next day, he repeated it. When Trump was asked, do you support
Palestinian? The next day, he called Schumer
Palestinian. Yeah, and he was anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim and anti-Arab, right? And then also at the debate, when asked about two states, he punted it. I also want people to remember that Netanyahu and Ben-Gavir want Trump to win. Also, behind closed doors, and Norm quoted Biden, he said that behind closed doors, that he sleeps at 8 p.m. So did George W. Bush, who was much younger. He stopped, and so did Reagan, right? But Trump said he let them finish the job, and also he's courting Miriam Adelson's money, who is pledged to give $100 million, provided that they can annex the West Bank. So on Palestine, on immigration, and on Islamophobia and the Muslim ban, and every other issue, folks, Trump will be worse. So this is what I'm looking at. I'm looking at the big picture. I am not excited about Biden. And you know who else is not excited about Biden? But they did the right thing. And the last thing I'll say is look to black voters and specifically the CBC, the Congressional Black Democratic Caucus. And the reason why I'm saying that, historically, that has been the base, the bellwether of the Democratic Party. Black women in particular have always saved this democracy, right? They know what's at risk. That's why they always put their economic anxiety second to protect the nation. And you're seeing the CBC, which is not representative of all black voters, of course, but is a good bellwether. Stacey Abrams, who helped give him Georgia, came out for Biden. You're seeing the black Democrats say, you know what? We've done the analysis. We looked at all the arguments. Biden-Harris is the ticket. So for me, that's the bellwether.
So, Norm, if you could respond, Wajahat has made a number of points, if you could respond to each of them. I mean, in particular, the fact that there are progressive Democrats who've backed Biden, most of the squad, the Congressional Progressive Caucus. If you could respond.
Yeah, the progressives in Capitol Hill who are under pressure, they're dealing with their own pressure situation. Reality is, for instance, polling for many months, including now, has shown that Biden's support among African-Americans and Latinos has plummeted compared to 2020. We can't or should not blame the messengers for the bad news. The idea that we should be unified behind a candidate who is headed for catastrophic defeat, according to virtually all of the people paying attention to the polling where it's going, I think that's a mistake. I think it's a way of internalizing conventional political wisdom. It's a way of fearing a process where an emerging other candidate could make it possible to get out of this deep hole that we're in. We are in a deep ditch. And Biden's refusal to deal with reality has driven not just himself, not just his own ostensible ticket, but the entire up and down the ballot of Democrats into a fever pitch of panic. Now, we can say that we know better than the pollsters. We can say we know better than those who are freaking out on Capitol Hill because they don't want to lose the Senate, because they don't want to lose their own races in the House and Senate. We can say that we know better. But to tune out so much information, to pretend that it doesn't matter what Biden is saying. And by the way, there's not a major candidate for president in our lifetimes who said, I'm not going to campaign after 8 p.m. It's not about taking a nap. It's about somebody who, as the New York Times reported 5 days after the debate, for many, many months has in individual interactions and meetings as well, really concerned people because his sentences didn't end. Often his thoughts did not connect and did not have a logical conclusion. He would sort of trail off. This is the guy who's supposed to be leading the charge for the next 4 months to defeat the Republican Party, to defeat Donald Trump. I frankly think that that is borderline absurd. And I do believe that if we're going to be realistic about where we are now, it's not enough for us to make speeches, as we should, about how horrific a Trump second term would be. I completely concur with everyone who is saying that we must prevent Trump from winning again. Our huge problem right now is that President Biden is refusing to step aside. We have unknowns if he does step aside. We have knowns if he refuses to step aside. We would have a candidate who appears, from all indications, to be incapable of fighting his way back from a very substantial deficit, which has gotten worse in the last 2 weeks. We, as whether we identify as progressives or anyone else, if we don't want a neo-fascist takeover of the executive branch and all of Congress, then we have to come to terms with where we really are now. And that question of denial, which is radiating out of the White House every day, really 24/7, from the spin masters of the White House, oh, it's not so bad. Oh, Biden is really in control. What you saw, you didn't see during the debate 2 weeks ago. What you saw a week ago with George Stephanopoulos on ABC News, you didn't really see it. Who are you going to believe, what you saw and heard, or the White House spin masters and those who are with wishful thinking telling us to just plow ahead behind the Biden train? There is a train wreck that is very foreseeable around the bend. And when you see a train wreck around the bend, you've got to pull the emergency cord. You need to do everything you can to get Biden off the ticket.
Your response to that, I mean, do you think everybody's priority is defeating Trump, all the people who are saying whether Biden should stay or go? Is there no candidate you can think of who would be likely more successful than Biden at defeating Trump?
So speaking about the polls, when they've done this magical pairing of these two magical people, right, the greatest advantage that any pairing has is 1 point. 1 point. That's it. So you pair Harris with someone else, plus one. That means we're still within striking distance. If Norm and anyone else can show me any polls that any other magical pairing other than Biden gives us plus seven, plus eight, beyond, you know, the 4 points of error, sure. We've only seen a 1 point shift. As of today, the polls, it's evened out, right? The popular vote, I think you just saw in the news today, it's 46-46. Biden's a little bit behind, but still within striking distance. So I think you have a small risk here, but it's even riskier to break apart this coalition, especially after you have had the progressives, AOC, Bernie Sanders, the CBC, and Kamala Harris say, hey, we're with Biden, and the fact that Biden, after 2 weeks, has said, I'm still in, and then go into the convention, magically come up with two people, and no poll has shown me that that has a plus five, plus seven, plus 10. 4 months. Unite, fight. I believe we can win.
Norm Salmon, we just have 20 seconds. Your final comment.
Oh, uniting behind a losing candidate is a bad idea. I think it's really improper to cite the popular vote when the reality is, as we've seen twice in this century, it's about the swing states. And in the swing states, Biden is tanking. So we can talk about popular vote all we want. It's about the battlefield states. Now, New York, according to the polling, is a swing state. That's how bad it is with Biden on the ticket. We've got to get him off the ticket.
We're going to have to leave it there. But before we go, Nermeen and I wanted to wish Nuseiba a very happy 8th birthday. Your daughter, Waj, on first Sunday, that she has battled and defeated 4th stage liver cancer.
She, right before the pandemic, when she was 3, she had stage 4 liver cancer. She needed a full liver transplant. An anonymous donor stepped up. His name is Sean Zaheer, no longer anonymous.
You just put out to the world?
Yeah, put out to the world, and 500 people signed up to be a liver donor, mostly strangers, and one person stepped up, Sean. And fast forward 5 years, half of my brain is about saving democracy. The other half of my brain is about planning this big water balloon fight for Nuseiba, my little diva, on Sunday. So thank you so much. She's alive. She's healthy. She's cancer-free. She has 2 costume changes a day. And, you know, if you need hope, people need hope, Amy. Have hope, folks. We're fighting for democracy. I have faith in us. And I see Nuseiba every day, and I'm like, you know what? We were in the darkest periods. People said she wouldn't survive. And look at her now. She's thriving.
And indeed, organ donors save lives.
Organ donors. And if you're watching right now, please, you can give a piece of your liver.
You can say it right
into
that camera.
You can give a piece of your liver. The liver grows back. I had no idea. The liver grows back. You can also give your kidney. And the one beautiful thing about Nuseiba's story is I got a message last week from someone who said, I never knew about live donations. I follow your daughter's story. I just got matched up, and I'm paired up with a kid. So imagine the lives that can be saved. If you're watching right now, think about donating a piece of the liver. The liver, it grows back.
We're going to leave it there, and I want to thank you so much.
Thank
again.
You.
Happy birthday, Nuseiba. Wajahat Ali is a Daily Beast columnist and runs the Left Hook Substack. Norman Salomon is executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, co-founder of RootsAction.org, which sponsors the Step Aside Joe campaign. Next up, we look at the state of the Gaza ceasefire and hostage negotiations. A framework for a deal has been reportedly agreed to by Hamas and Israel. Stay with us.
That was lovely.
is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The Washington Post is reporting Israel and Hamas have agreed to the framework for a new ceasefire and hostage deal following talks in Cairo and Doha. Washington Post columnist David Ignatius reports a senior U.S. official told him that the parties are now, quote, negotiating details of how it will be implemented. But a final deal may not be imminent. This comes as Israel intensifies its attacks on Gaza while ordering all civilians in Gaza City to leave the city, despite having no safe place to go. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem decried the evacuation order of the city as, quote, absolute madness.
On the diplomatic front, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports Israel negotiators have returned from Doha for consultations with Israeli leaders. In Doha, the Israeli negotiators met with Egyptian, Qatari, and U.S. officials. On the U.S. side, it was CIA Director William Burns. On the Israeli side, it was the head of Mossad, David Barnea. We're joined now by Daniel Levy, president of the U.S. Middle East Project, former Israeli peace negotiator, joining us from London. Thanks so much for being with us again. Can you explain what's at stake? What is this three-stage deal, Daniel?
Yes, indeed. Good to be with you. So the idea is that in the initial phase, there would be the withdrawal of the troops from large parts of Gaza, the Israeli military. You would have the release of those Israelis being held who are still alive and are not male soldiers. You would allow the real ramping up of humanitarian access. Of course, that should happen anyway. And you would have Palestinian prisoners being released. And then you would move on to a second phase where there would be a more significant Palestinian prisoner release, a full Israeli military withdrawal. The remaining soldiers would be released. And a third phase in which bodies would be returned. And there would be the start of more consummate rehabilitation efforts. But those are supposed to flow 1 to 2 to 3. The big question, and it's been the question for months, is whether you can just do phase one and then continue with the destruction, with everything you've been reporting on for months now, 21,000 children unaccounted for, 38,000 dead in Gaza and counting, and that's without knowing what's under the rubble. Does that continue? Or are there serious commitments that this will be a permanent cessation of this kind of hostility? And here's the rub. The document is trying to create a degree of constructive ambiguity, I think. And Hamas have said, look, we know there's nothing ironclad. I'm paraphrasing, okay? We know there's nothing ironclad, but we need to know with maximum plausibility that there is a commitment to this being a permanent cessation. And what you have on every occasion is the Israeli prime minister stepping forward and say, whoa, no, I am committing to continuing the war until its objectives are realized. Those objectives are unrealizable. The military knows that. The families of the hostages know that. And therefore, he is trying to do everything to prevent a deal. And what we are seeing in the reportage is, unfortunately, still a lot of unsubstantiated optimism and, from the U.S. administration, continued deception.
So, Daniel, if you could talk about, I mean, there was renewed hope that a deal could be reached after Hamas last week reportedly gave up on its initial demand that a permanent ceasefire be part of the first phase of any agreement. So if you could talk about the significance of Hamas doing that, why you think that they took that step, and the fact that there's such, I mean, increasing opposition within Israel to Netanyahu's stance, not just from hostage families, but this latest move that he made, saying that, you know, that Israel, one of the conditions should be that Israel can resume fighting until conditions are met, that people were so widely critical within Israel of Netanyahu taking that position. Do you think that might make any difference in the short term?
Okay, so on the Hamas side of things, I think there has been a deliberate misinterpretation of the Hamas position. The permanent ceasefire was never locked into phase one. It was always part of the transition from phase one to phase two. And there has constantly been this question of how to make that as reasonable, as likely as possible. Now, Hamas may be looking at this. I'm not privy to their internal conversations, of course. Hamas may be looking at this and saying, we're still here. We will be here if the Israelis resume their actions after a six-week hiatus. We now have a situation where, in order to dial down the escalation on the northern Israel-Lebanon, Israel-Hezbollah front, you very clearly need our situation to be dialed down. Maybe we can get the kind of humanitarian relief in that all of these things will make it increasingly difficult for Israel, even if that's what they intend, to resume these kinds of actions after 6 weeks, and we have a more desperate administration in the U.S. That might suggest where some additional wiggle room has been created. However, that wiggle room, I don't think, can be sufficient enough to sustain what you mentioned in the second part of your question, which is to sustain a very vocal, very transparent and insistent Israeli forcing the issue that no, there can be no permanent ceasefire. Netanyahu put out four conditions. One of them was any deal will allow Israel to resume fighting until all of the objectives of the war have been achieved. So that doesn't give you an ability to work. Now, what about what's going on inside Israel? Your question regarding, is the pressure now at a place where Netanyahu simply has to accept this? The unfortunate answer, and I so hope I'm wrong with all of this, the unfortunate answer is no, you do have greater protests, you do have the families more mobilized, you do have a military that is more clearly saying, again, I'm paraphrasing, if we want a chance to deal with the situation in the north, whether de-escalating or having the attention span to deal militarily, then you need a ceasefire in Gaza. The military, by the way, prefers a deal. They prefer a ceasefire deal in Gaza because they know that's the only way they'll get a significant cohort of the hostages out. And they know that their reservists, their troops, have been on the front line for an awfully long time and are rather exhausted. So the military more transparently has said that. You do have the parliament going into a summer recess. And so the hope, I think, was that Netanyahu could tell his right-wing, even more extreme than himself, coalition allies, guys, don't leave me during the summer recess. There's no urgency here. I promise you that by the time the parliament is back after the Jewish holidays in October, I'll be killing Palestinians just like I've done and just like you like me to do. We'll be fighting a war in Gaza. In the meantime, you can have fun in the West Bank, causing provocation, causing mayhem, displacing Palestinians. Don't rush to do anything crazy. And they are saying, no, we're going to bring you down. And Netanyahu is looking around. And he sees that the domestic pressure inside Israel is not a threat to his coalition stability. And crucially, he is seeing that the U.S. administration will continue when push comes to shove to say, oh, it's Hamas's fault. And they will continue to send the weapons without which Israel could not be causing this death and destruction, the 500-pound bombs released again. And he knows he has a nice little date with Congress following the invitation by the Republican and Democratic congressional leadership, Daniel, on the 20th July.
Let's talk about July 24th. Yes, Netanyahu is scheduled to address a joint session of Congress on July 24th. A number of prominent Israelis, including a former head of Mossad, a former prime minister, and a Nobel Prize winner, have written a joint op-ed in the New York Times headlined, "We are Israelis calling on Congress to disinvite Netanyahu." They argue the invitation will make a ceasefire agreement more unlikely. They write, "Netanyahu's supporters in Israel will be emboldened by his appearance in Congress to insist the war continue, which will further distance any deal to secure the release of the hostages, including several U.S. citizens. Giving Mr. Netanyahu the stage in Washington will all but dismiss the rage and pain of his people, as expressed in the demonstrations throughout the country. American lawmakers should not let this happen. They should ask Mr. Netanyahu to stay home." Your response to this?
I don't like giving one-word responses, but it would be amen. So if you're looking at it from the Israeli perspective, then absolutely the way that the congressional leadership, but I would argue the way the administration has behaved, has cut off at the knees any prospect of the shift in Israel that's necessary to end this war that has led to the ICC and the ICJ, those international courts taking those measures. By the way, if I was looking at this from the perspective of international law in general and the perspective of the Palestinians living under these conditions, I would say, how the hell can you invite Netanyahu? But let me just say this, because you referenced that piece by Ignatius in the Washington Post. And here's what most concerns me this morning. Ignatius is not writing as his own opinion here. He's a consummate insider. He is being a faithful stenographer of the spin being given to him by the administration. And Ignatius writes the following, that it would be a ringing validation of President Biden's patient diplomacy and a potential valedictory moment if he got this ceasefire. Now, just pause. What the spin that the administration is telling us is, wow, we could get it through our patient diplomacy. Can I translate the term patient diplomacy? Patient diplomacy means that after 9 months, you have tens of thousands who are dead, 9 out of 10 people who are displaced, starvation, humanitarian catastrophe, scholasticide. This is patient diplomacy that you should be proud of. The hostages are still there. America's international reputation, that which was still remaining as an upholder of international law, has been thoroughly taken to the cleaners. And, of course, there's the internal situation on the Democrat side. And I would simply say, because I listened to your earlier segment, that you have a real problem if you think you can sell this spin. And if you treat your voters with contempt, you do that at your own risk. I'm sitting here in the UK, and I've just come back from Paris. I'll tell you what happened in our elections here. In our elections here, Labour won a stunning majority in Parliament, but lost and only received 34% in the popular vote, 6% less than Corbyn in 2017. Why? Because voters deserted Labour over Gaza. And then in France, you saw a new left alliance come together, close the enthusiasm gap with the right. Yes, it was about keeping the extreme right out, but it was also because one of the things that new left alliance did was to come up with a credible position on Gaza. And I would simply ask the question, is this stunning validation of your approach what you're going to be selling people? And you still haven't got the ceasefire. You're still sending the weapons. You are still in violation of international law.
And finally, Daniel, I wanted to ask you about the position of the Israeli military, which are becoming, as you've pointed out, more and more public in their opposition to the war. What is the significance of that, and could that make a difference?
Wow, it's a big issue. So what's going on here is the military knows they have no political plan. They're being sent on a mission that is unachievable. They've actually openly said you cannot defeat Hamas in the way Netanyahu talks about this de-radicalization agenda in Gaza. It's for the birds. So I think what the military are saying is we need a different approach. The problem here, in addition to, of course, what the military has been conducting in Gaza, is that these are the same guys in the military who were in charge on October 7th. And there is a fight. There is a blame game between the military leadership and Netanyahu.
We have 20 seconds, Daniel.
Was it political failure or was it military failure? You have blame games when there is a failure. That's what it is. And Netanyahu may replace some of this military, and that could be even more dangerous by the way.
Daniel Levy, I want to thank you for being with us, president of the U.S. Middle East Project, former Israeli peace negotiator under Israeli Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting live from the Milwaukee Republican Convention and the Chicago Democratic Convention, expanding to 2 hours every day. And we have a development director position opening to lead our fundraising efforts. You can check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Interested in joining improv sessions? 4 seasoned facilitators are holding an event involving climate change on July 12th between 7 and 9 p.m. All experience levels are welcome, and light snacks will be provided as well. The event takes place at Moberly Arts and Cultural Center with a performance at the end of the show. For more info and to RSVP, you can find them on Instagram at instagram.com/jinsolostalgia.